Hello, and welcome to A Taste of the Past on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Linda Palacio, your host, and today's program is being sponsored by TechServe. The Heritage Radio Network is supported by TechServe. It has an e-waste recycling event created to help keep hazardous materials out of landfills by recycling electronics. Saturday, July 10th, here in New York City, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. is the event at 23rd Street near 6th Avenue. Info at techserve.com will tell you everything you know about the recycling program. And today we have a special event, too, and that is something we're doing here on Heritage Radio Network. For the lucky caller or emailer, our fifth caller or emailer today will receive free porterhouse pork chops from Heritage Foods USA and tickets to the New York City Film Festival events, the wonderful food on film events that are happening throughout the city this month. So email, if you've logged on, all you have to do is email us. There's a link at the bottom. Or you can call at 718-497-2128. Today we have a very, very special guest who is also a host of his own show, Jimmy Carbone, who hosts Beer Sessions here on Heritage Radio Network. Welcome, Jimmy.
Hi, Linda. How are you?
I'm fine, and I know I'm going to do even better after we crack open one of those beers. Hold on. Just turn up your volume on your headphones, and you should be okay. And we have little technical difficulties here. And we're talking, of course, what else are we going to talk
about? I think that sounds good.
There you go. We're going to talk about
craft beer.
There you go. Gee, I thought it was wine. No. But before we do that, this is a show about culinary history. Now, history can be long ago, or history can be in the making, right?
Yes.
I mean, you're making history. The people who are making the craft beers are making history. But just sort of to set up why all this attention to beer all of a sudden is, you sort of have to know where we came from. And it's a lot of people think that wine is the oldest beverage, alcoholic beverage, that was brewed. And, you know, thinking of the Romans, of course, probably. But beer really is one of the oldest beverages known to anthropologists and archaeologists. And they found evidence, you know, in those pottery amphoras and jars, chemical evidence dating back as far as 5,000 BCE of people brewing beer. The Sumerians and the Mesopotamians, we know, brewed beer. A lot of this all followed. As soon as they knew they learned how to harvest grains. They would grow grains, obviously, because they had to live, and they would stay in an area for a while in fertile plains, grow the grains. A way of preserving the grains ended up in some fermentation, and voila, they had beer. And then that, of course, you know, pursued. Most of the brewing was domestic brewing, but not long. I mean, you get into about the 3rd century BCE, and you actually have mass production, I mean, brewing and, you know, in the Asiatic lands in the Far East. In fact, in China, the evidence of beer goes back even further. They probably about 7,000 BCE, there's the evidence of them having brewed beer. And then rice quickly took over, and then rice wines were brewed. About the Middle Ages, or even before the Middle Ages, the monks took over the monasteries. I think, you know, interesting. You wonder why. why they took over. They had to sublimate all those other desires into something, except why not brew and get drunk, right? But beer has an interesting history of being medicinal also, and healthy. It's got a lot of nutrition and carbohydrates in it, right? Well, Jimmy's going, yeah, but let's just drink it.
Well, you could have a pure vegetarian diet just by drinking good beer.
There you go. Right. And so now all of a sudden beer, you know, primarily the brewers and as far back as the Middle Ages, even before, actually long before, were women.
I've heard that.
Did you?
Yes.
And there's a prayer or a hymn to Ninkazi, the goddess of beer.
The story is that as things were more home-based or agriculture-based, women did it. And then somehow when it became like profit-based or control, there was some kind of corporate or church control, it became men.
Then the men came in. Well, and the I think the monks taking over had a lot to do with that as well. Yeah, well, the Industrial Revolution came along, and it became, you know, mass-produced. Well, happy for some people.
Yeah, it's hard to relate to that. I mean, that's one thing when you talk about food history, trying to relate to how it's changed. I mean, we still think we go to the store or a bar and we get a bottle of beer or, you know, beer on draft, and you forget how simple it is to make. And the rise of the homebrew movement now is the real story, because it people can make it in their home with very simple ingredients.
Well, that's what I wanted to get to, because first of all, I didn't give you the proper introduction, assuming people all know who you are from your show on the radio, Beer Sessions. But Jimmy is the owner of Jimmy's 43, which is an uber beer bar. And you present a lot of really fine craft beers. And I got to tell you, I'm on Facebook. Jimmy's one of my friends on Facebook, whether you knew it or not, or Jimmy's 43 is or whatever. I think I get more notifications on Facebook from Jimmy's than anything else. But you are a fantastic promoter of the craft beer movement. And you have you have wonderful events all the time presenting different craft beers. But the Jimmy's 43 is a terrific beer bar in the East Village in New York City, for those who don't know. And you're also the co-founder of the Good Beer Seal. So before we get into talking about these new craft beers and how they're brewed, I want to know, what is the Good Beer Seal?
Well, the Good Beer Seal, about 2 years ago, there were some new kind of beer promotions in New York. One of them was called New York City Craft Beer Week. And some of the bar owners got together and said, you know, we really need to do something where we just talk about our bars. And it became, we created this thing, Good Beer Seal. And wow, going back to talking about food history, this is almost history now to me. I'm trying to remember what we did. We decided that we wanted to focus on the small, independently owned bars that served really good craft beer. As opposed to, because at that time there were a lot of new larger bars opening that were focusing on good beer and some corporate owned places, and we said, you know, what we really like is we like small independently owned places where you can meet the owner, and those places somehow did it, you know, was it just a whatever collaboration or, you know, or was it just nature that the small owned places did the best job of promoting the beer, of having beer education, of having hospitality? You know, was it something that a larger bar would have to buy? You know, it seemed like it was missing. I think I'm trying to say the hospitality and the sense of the importance of the beer and the beer education seemed to be missing from the larger establishments.
So this association, you feel, raised the bar?
Yeah, so I think that we
raised the bar of bars.
Yeah, we like places where it's like, oh, I'm going to say it again, small owner operated places seem to have the right vibe, seem to represent the beers the way that we like, seem to be the places we wanted to go. And as I talked to one or two bar owners, I talked to the guy who owned Burp Castle, I talked to the guy who owns DBA, and next thing they all recommended one or two other guys. And next thing you know, we had 15 bars. Hmm. They were all the same in the sense that they were small, independently owned, that their focus was really good craft beer. And we had a very short list, and we're like, wow, there might be a few more than this, but there's not that many places that are doing this. You know, a lot of places are serving beer, but there weren't that many that were really focused on just serving good craft beer and a, you know, kind of intimate, you know, environment.
Well, an example of what a good promoter you are, by forming this association, you even then went to the mayor's office, Mayor Bloomberg, and you got a proclamation,
we wrote to
right?
the mayor, and we said, why don't we write to the mayor? This will be our big, our PR push was going to be, will the mayor declare July to be Good Beer Month? And then after we had the posters printed, we got a phone call, and we said, uh-oh, we better change our poster, because the mayor did proclaim July to be Good Beer Month, and they're doing it again this year, too.
So this is the second year running, very appropriate you're on now. Here we are at the end of June, because you've got events happening.
Promotion. Yeah,
yeah. So July, in New York City, July is officially Good Beer
this
Month.
This will be the
right?
second year, and the mayor's office has called us, so we know we're going to get it again. And it's kind of like an open platform thing. Rather than having one person just control and program and plan, it's become an open platform. Brooklyn Edible in Manhattan jumped mm-hmm. on board last year. They set up an event called Good Beer at BAM, which is a great like beer and food event at BAM Cafe. It's going to be July 11th this year.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of intimate. For beer events, it's intimate. There's only about 400 tickets sold. And you get to meet 15 different restaurateurs with their food and 15 different brewers or their representatives. And it's a really nice event. People the beer is served in wine glasses, stemmed wine glasses, and you walk around, and it's kind of like more like a wine tasting than a beer tasting. But no one had done anything like that, and everyone's like, wow, that's a great beer tasting. So Edible came in and did that. Now some of the breweries on board. Brooklyn Brewery is doing a couple small events. Kelso, which is another brewery in Brooklyn, they're going to do a boat cruise to kick off the month, July 2nd. And July 31st, they're going to end it with a hot dog eating competition.
Oh, great.
And some of the Good Beer Still Bar owners got together with Josh Zersky, who's a food writer, and we're putting on this event called Meatopia on July 11th. And that's going to be 30...
From Governor's Island,
yeah,
right?
30 yeah. barbecuers and chefs, including Fatty Q.
Yeah.
And we're going to have 6 Points, going to be our exclusive beer, and they're going to make a custom beer on... smoked ale. We're going to meet next Monday, the 28th, at 6 Point Brewery, and we're going to get together and make a custom smoked ale for the event.
Just for the event. Oh, that's wonderful.
And that's a historic kind of
there you
of
go.
Beer.
It is. Definitely.
I want to talk about some history.
Yeah.
I'll tell you about, mind if I talk about smoked beers?
Well, you want to talk about that now, or let's define craft. What is a craft beer? I mean, people talk about this, you know, craft beer movement. Oh, come here, we'll order this craft beer from the menu. What designates a craft beer from, you know, let's say a Bud?
Well, the first thing is size of production, and I think craft is kind of defining itself still. I think the word's getting used by a lot of different people, but I still think if you say craft beer, there's a sense of some small production, quality ingredients, but there's not like the only true definition of like a beer. There's a Rahites. It's a German purity law. I forget what it's called, Rahizen boats or something.
Right, they did. In the 1500s, they passed that purity law. That was like 1575, I think.
Yeah, and that's the only country, I think Norway also does it, that's the only country that really defines what beer can be, and no other country does that. So, you know, you can go to Germany, there's like a certain kind of grain, and there's yeast, and there's hops, and water, and that's it. You know, and there's nothing else. You can't add anything else. Like in Belgium, you can do things with flavorings. You can add candied sugar to boost the alcohol level. And if you ever drink a really good German beer, you realize, wow, I don't get a headache.
Yeah.
Because they're not adding sugar. They're not adding other things.
But you mentioned the small, intimate, you know, 400 ticket from tasting.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's true. You go to Germany and they have these beer halls that are just in the beer gardens, which are fabulous. But, I mean, they're just huge. Of course, you bring a picnic, or they do serve some Lieberkasse or something, you know, and you drink some good beer. That came to New York too in the late 1800s, and the Germans came in, and there were big, huge beer halls in New York City. So
yeah, beer halls and rats. Even I saw an old photo of Chinatown, and even Chinese restaurants use the word Ratskeller. It'd be like, you know, dumpling Ratskeller or something.
Yeah. So here we are going back to craft beers and. But you said it's not necessarily the size of the brewery. I mean, there's some large producers who make craft beers.
The example from Germany is that all German breweries have to follow the purity law, but they could be as big as Beck's or as small as a little microbrewery. Mm-hmm. So that hasn't really defined craft. It just says that they have laws about the ingredients. So in this country, you know, microbrewing is defined. I think it's defined as making fewer than like 50,000 barrels.
But craft beer is different from microbrew. I mean,
I'm saying microbrew is defined. Someone might correct me on this, but I'm pretty sure it's 50,000 barrels, which means 100,000 kegs a year, which is nothing. Because Bud, it's kind of like craft beer is kind of like the anti-Bud. I think that's the way to define it. But microbrewing, you know, a microbrewery is defined. There's a nanobrewery, which is like 5 gallons or something.
Home, that's in your kitchen.
Yeah. Well, there's guys doing it commercially. That there's a guy, Sean Bell up in Vermont, a couple other guys, and they have a very small, almost like a homebrew setup, and they have a license and they sell it.
Well, Vermont was real a forerunner in craft brews, I think. I mean, to my memory knowledge, you know, back in the 80s there were a lot of, you know, Magic Hat and all these things popping up all over the place,
and now a lot of those guys aren't technically microbrews. I know that, like,
are they craft? I mean, yeah. They did brew a lot. I mean, now they're sold, you know, Long Trail, so they're all sold in grocery stores.
Yeah, so you got to say what's craft. Well, I think that size does matter, because, you know, you're assuming that the smaller production is going to get probably a better quality ingredient and a little more attention to it. It's also I think it's like a PR thing too. Craft kind of defines a lifestyle. It's the beer that's not Budweiser. It's almost, that's the easiest way to define it.
Yeah.
If you're not one of those big breweries, Budweiser, Miller, Coors, you can almost say you're craft. But there's also there's regional breweries too.
Right.
So there's some that you wouldn't really call them craft, but they're regional. I think craft assumes that, you know, maybe it's an IPA, maybe there's more flavor. I think, or it's really well made, or there's some really interesting, you know, qualities to it, which come down to the ingredients and the
Well, now we're going to define IPA for our listeners too, and talk about the flavorings and the ingredients and smoked beer when we come back after a short break. Okay.
Love me so, didn't matter anymore. I say she never cared and that she never will. I do it all again. I guess I'll have to wait until then. If I get drunk, well, I'll pass out on the floor now, baby. You won't bother me no more. If I'm drinking, well, you know that you're my friend and I'll say, I think I'll have myself a beer. Woo-hoo-hoo. She called me late last night, say she loved me so. But I guess you changed her mind. Well, I should have known it wouldn't be alright. But I can't live without her, so I won't even try. If I get drunk, well, I'll pass out on the floor now, baby. You won't bother me no more. If you're drinking, well, you know that you're my friend, and I'll say, I think I'll have myself a beer.
We are back on A Taste of the Past and with Jimmy Carbone and beer. And we've got a few, to describe and explain to all of you what a craft beer is and the different flavorings. Jimmy brought along some beers. I'm sorry you can't taste them, but I can. And the first one he opened for me is Saisonette, an Italian saison ale brewed with spices, juniper, chinotto peel, coriander. Let's see what this is like.
So this is a real craft beer. I mean, this is like the best ingredient.
Well,
that was a pour, Linda. That was
right.
Great.
All right.
And you know, this is a real small production beer, and it's got unique ingredients that were native to that part of Italy, like Chinotto, and it's a saison style, which is like a, you know, kind of a Belgian style beer. It's like, and a lot of small breweries around the world are doing what this beer is they're taking like a traditional style, like a Belgian saison, and they're adding, you know, their local ingredients to it.
Well, now adding flavorings like this would be out of the realm then of what the Germans consider, you know, their purity law.
Yeah, right? the Germans wouldn't do this, but right. Most of the other countries, people do add flavors.
Now, it's not as aromatic as I expected. I expected it to be a little. It's very light. It's very nice.
Yeah, and it's also
bitter.
Cold.
It's
cold.
Finish.
It just came out of the bottle and just took it in a taxi. Mm-hmm. But it's a very subtle beer. Mm-hmm. Just that finish, that little Chinotto kind of slight bitterness.
Yeah, not a bitter that, you know, that stays with you.
Just yeah, and this is the kind of beer that people that are making all over the world right now. You know, even in Nordic countries and they're taking Belgian style and they're adding some of their own local flavors and ingredients. So it's slightly unique. But it's this is the ultimate craft beer. Like these places in like Italy, there's some of the best craft breweries in the world right now. Really small. There's even one in a prison, where you know, kind of like monks, you're in a monastery, you're almost in a prison. Their idea is like, well, these guys are in prison.
Let's get them to work, right?
And let's sell beer and pay for the prison.
Well, what a smart idea.
And then another thing I brought this pretty good California IPA, Bear Republic
Indian Pale Ale, for those who are.
India Pale Ale.
Not well informed on beers, you know. And, I think everyone knows that these days.
The story of India Pale Ale, if it's pretty straightforward, but it's another good food history. You know, people in Britain drank a lot of beer. You know, 300 years ago, more people drank beer than water. They had kind of lighter versions of beer that they call milds. And there was even some beer that was hardly beer at all, but it's what people drank. People didn't really drink water.
They didn't drink water for a good reason. The water, they didn't know the source of the water. They'd get sick if they drank the water.
So all the troops, you know, the Brits were in India.
Better bourbon.
And all the troops needed beer. And the beer, by the time it got there, it was spoiled. So they added hops as a preservative, because hops is a preservative.
And that's where the hops came in, huh?
And they added the alcohol. They boosted the alcohol level. Mm. So they made it a stronger beer with hops that traveled well. And thus the style was born, the India Pale Ale, which now is making a huge comeback. Everybody drinks IPA.
Yeah.
And every craft brewery makes an IPA, because it's kind of, to me, it is kind of the beer of the craft beer movement.
Yeah. You know? Well, and especially a lot of people who don't like the heavier, you know, wheat flavor, the real heavy beers, you taste the IPA and it's like, oh, it's elegant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's one reason, talking about flavors, I think that's one reason why I think the original craft breweries made beers with more flavor than Bud. That was one thing they did to stand out, and that's a reason why people often go from drinking like a Bud or a Miller to a better beer. They go to a beer with more flavor, and you know, one style is an IPA. Hmm. And often in a bar, you'll pretty much see IPA in almost every bar now. But people who think of themselves as beer drinkers be like, oh yeah, I'll drink the IPA. It's kind of like the go-to beer now.
Well, when you go to order some of these craft beers, what we didn't mention before is that a craft beer does not necessarily mean it has to be local. I mean, you brought imported beers. You brought a German. You brought a Belgian.
Belgian, and German.
And Italian.
Italian, right. And California.
And California, right.
Yeah.
So it's not that it has to be local. You can,
no, well, if anything, is the local beers that are made here that I like the best. I like Chelsea Brewery. I like Brooklyn. I like Kelso. I like Six Point, of course, because I'm always drinking Six Point. But mostly I get their beer on draft.
Hmm.
So I could have put some in a little growler for you, a little container, but yeah. I didn't. So that's the other reason I have my bottle beers are imported. Right. But most of the local beers I carry are draft.
So how are you gonna do the smoked? How is Six Point gonna do the smoked beer?
Well, talking again about history. Originally, they turn the grain into malt or grain, they have to roast it.
Right.
And they roast it to different colors to get different flavors. But also, as you get a darker malt, that's what they call the roasted grain, it actually influences the color of the beer. So at one point, the only way to roast grain was over an open fire.
Over a fire, yeah.
So any beer, I believe that any beer historically probably had a hint of smoke in it. Because as they roasted the malt, it absorbed the flavors, including the smoke.
And they put on a new log, and the smoke rose up, and there you
That's
go.
It. So I think that all beers used to have a hint of smoke.
Huh.
And it was probably only when they had enclosed ovens and things, maybe 200 years ago, that you were able to, bake the malt without getting the smoke flavor in there. So, it's another thing about, wow, as things got more modern, more technology, they took out the flavor, they took out the color, but the real way that the beer was made had a little smokiness to it, had a little color to it, you know, like a lightish brown kind of beer was probably what everyone drank.
Yeah. Well, I think you're right about the smoking, that probably everything did have a smoky flavor. Interesting, because I'm going to a tea and wine tasting next week, and, tea tastings are being compared a lot of the flavors of wines. And there are some of the old and fine teas are very smoky as well. Very smoky teas. Lapshangs are.
I love smoky teas.
Yeah, they smell like smoke. So I think it would be great to taste that smoky.
Yeah. So I'm not sure how we're going to do it, but I mean they're the brewmasters. They're going to take care of it at Six Point. But
of course, after you eat all that smoked meat, are you going to be able to taste the smoke in the beer? I don't know. It might be hard to discern one from the other.
Right? Well, it's a throwback beer. retro beer or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But the funny thing is, I'm sure you experience this with food all the time. It's like as things got more modern, the flavors get stripped out. And that's one thing that mass production could do is, wow, they can make a really clean beer that without flavor. And,
but what are we drinking? What are we eating? We can't tell.
So that's the whole craft beer movement too. Is like, hey, the way that beer was made, and a lot of people are going back to old recipes. You'll see 1807 Berliner Weisse, or they're going back to a recipe that had once been made that was no longer made. And there's just so much diversity of flavor. There's sour beers.
Mm-hmm.
There's beers aged in wood. There's really hoppy beers like the IPA. There's really strong beers like triples. I mean, the diversity of beer now, it's better than ever, but it's all because of the craft beer movement.
Right. Well, it's interesting. I just heard a commercial on the radio the other day for some place in New Jersey where you can come and you don't even brew your own. You just come and show up and tell them what kind of grain you want in there, and they'll cook it up for you, and you come back, you know, half a day later, and you got your beer. I mean, this is huge. I mean, this is catching the, I mean, it's not a bad thing. It might not, you know, the quality of the beer, I'm sure, is not all that great. But I think what it speaks to is the fact that this movement is huge. People are really appreciating their beer. They're no longer satisfied just to have that bubbly liquid with no flavor, but you know, you get a buzz on after a few beers. Yeah. You know, that they really want to taste what they're drinking. And you're right that they're back to, you know, the craft movement where you really can taste what it is.
In the 80s, there was a kind of this first boom where there were all these small craft breweries. I think that in New York City in the late 80s, there were at least 11 microbrews or brew pubs.
Wow.
There was Zip City Brewery. There were a few others. I don't even remember. City, yeah. And I think by the early 90s, the only one left was Brooklyn.
Huh.
And because it was like that first boom, everybody said, let's open a brewery, let's open a microbrewery. Brew pubs were all over the country. A lot of them failed. And
why do you think that is? People, the movement hadn't caught on?
Yeah, I think, you know, early adapters, it was the something that's really new. A lot of people rushed into it. But then what happened was that set the tone. And then a little more professional breweries were set up where they had, you know, some financing, a really good brewer. You know, there were brewers, more brewers then too, so there was more talent. And initially there weren't that many brewers. So people started making it's like opening a small restaurant, which you can still do. Maybe you started cooking at home, and the next thing, you know, let's open a restaurant. Well, I guess at one time that might have worked for a small brewery, but it doesn't work like that anymore.
Well, it's funny, the late 60s, not to date myself, early 70s, the huge movement was, you know, make your own wine at home kind of thing. And then the movement kind of, you know, transformed into, you know, learn to brew your beer at home. And that came about, I guess, in the late 80s and the 90s. You know, everyone was a home brewer suddenly. So it's interesting that the movement has caught on. A little bit.
And actually, there was a law, and there was something, leftover legacies from Prohibition about home brewing, and Jimmy Carter signed a law. I'm not sure exactly what it was, but whatever he signed, it enabled people to make more beer at home, and also for more smaller breweries to start up.
Hmm.
It was an important law, because if he hadn't made that, this what we're talking about now would never have happened.
Well, I imagine it was, you know, I mean, not that profitable initially, and why a lot of those brew pubs failed. I mean, the sourcing of the grains, you know, the hops, I mean, a lot of where they got it would depend on what their final product tasted like, too.
Yeah, and there wasn't
what they had to pay.
There wasn't the market either. You know, right. It takes a while to develop. It's really that next generation. It's like the kids who are, you know, out of college, maybe in their 20s, are kind of grew up having the exposure to some good beer. And, you know, by the time they got out of college, this is what they expected. I mean, that's what we see at Jimmy's Number 43 and the other good beer sale bars, is this is what people drink.
Yeah.
You know, they don't even think about drinking a Bud. They're just drinking good beer. And that's what they're used to. So you have the audience kind of in place for the industry to grow around, too.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think I'll go out and start growing
Well, if you want to get into hops, that's right. If you looked at Edible Brooklyn, there's a great cover that just came out this week. And it's a guy, Ben, he owns Beercraft, which is a really great beer store.
Yeah.
And he's tending a 40-foot, hops really grow high. And in his backyard, he always grows hops. There's a 40-foot hop plant in his backyard, and he's up on a ladder.
Wow.
And that's the cover photo. It's really great. But that kind of shows the movement, too, that people are actually... He's a home brewer, but he also has a beer shop. And he's much more known as a beer retailer. I mean, he's got one of the best shops in the city. But he's also a home brewer, and he also grows his own hops. So that's kind of like... He's like the complete beer guy.
There you go.
Or it's that's, like 6 points. You know, Shane at 6.2, he was a home brewer. And they started real small with their 6-point brewery. And they've been expanding. And it's still a great place to go. I mean, he's still like... They're hands-on. He's got some great young guys working with him.
Interesting. I think that, the people who really love beer and love the taste of beer have helped this movement along. And people like you, of course, who host the events. And it's great because you will bring in and host events for a lot of different beer makers. I notice them coming through. Not only that, I mean, you host events for other food people all the time, too. But the different you know, the different beers that come out that people might not be exposed to otherwise. And it's a great
Well, that's, like I said, that's what all the really good, there's right now there's 27 Good Beer Seal bars. You can go to goodbeerseal.com and look at the list.
Goodbeerseal.com.
Good Beer Seal. And it was kind of a joke. It's actually a seal, picture of a seal drinking a beer.
I did see that, yes.
But, you know, goodbeerseal.com, and then those 27 bars, they all have tastings all the time. So if you ever, so for example, July Good Beer Month, what we're suggesting is, hey, go to, try each bar. You know, in 1 month, go to all 27 bars. And if you do, we'll give you a t-shirt. Beer Sessions t-shirt.
Beer Seal?
Beer Sessions Radio. Oh, I'm plugging my radio show.
Oh, good. All right. But now, this is New York alone. I mean, can you, are you looking to expand and go throughout the country, throughout the U.S. and try to spread the word?
We're
going
to see. I mean, this year, getting up to 27 in New York, it's, you know, this is the second year. We've heard that people think we should give the seal to restaurants, brew pubs, retail shops. So we'd have to think, I think, you know, in the fall, some of us will get together and we'll start thinking about what's the next step.
This could grow into a very big business.
Yeah, well, at this point, it's not a business. It's more like a hobby.
Yeah.
But, you know, we've targeted
some.
But
it's a lot of work. I mean,
it's a lot of work.
You know, you have to qualify, you know, which.
And there's some really good beer cities.
Like
Chicago's a good beer town, Philadelphia, even D.C. now. There's like a whole new resurgence with the new president and there's new restaurants opening. And, you know, it might be city by city. Maybe we'll go to another city or two and do a good beer sale there.
Well, just get somebody interested and tell them how to do it and, you know, expand.
And they can come on the radio
show. Expand your horizons there. Well, I think this has been really an education for me because I enjoy beer, but I don't really know much about craft beers, whatever's given to me. And someone says, oh, this is really a good, you know, Chinook ale or something, or, you know. And I have no idea until I taste it and I go, well, it's definitely not, you know, your standard beer. So this is interesting to hear you talk about the actual process. And I encourage people that not to just, you know, throw down a few brewskis. Well, that's good too. But to go and actually order, go to one of these, look up goodbeerseal.com if you're in New York. And if you're not in New York, go to your local brew pub and ask somebody for, I'm sure any bartender would help give an education, right? I mean,
yeah, a lot of bartenders know about beer. There's a great program. It's called the Cicerone Training Program, and they're training people that work in bars to be certified beer servers.
Hmm.
It's a great program. There's a gentleman named Sam Merritt.
He's
part of Beer Sessions Radio, and he's got civilizationofbeer.com. He does a lot of beer education classes. I think he's probably the leading beer educator right now in the whole city.
Hmm.
And
interesting.
If you want to, you can take courses with him at, I think, at ICE. As well as his Civilization of Beer courses at Jimmy's Number 43, which he does for the industry.
Terrific. Learning about beer.
I actually learned most of what I know about beer from his course.
Hmm. See, we have to learn all over again. And here it was, the oldest beverage. And we're just rediscovering it all over again. I think that's great. Well, I would like to thank you is for your great show and for your great brew pub, and well, I guess what do you call it?
Beer bar. Beer bar with food.
Beer bar. I call it the Uber beer bar. You know, it's a good beer bar and event space too. I mean, you've got a terrific event space. You've got, you know.
Yeah, tonight we have the Vista volunteers from Just Food, which is a great food organization. That they had a year's worth of volunteers from the Vista program, and they're leaving, but they're having a party tonight at Jimmy's Number 43. If you want to come meet some cool food people, Just Food people, they're at Jimmy's Number 43 tonight.
There you go. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Jimmy Carbone. Beer Sessions on HeritageRadioNetwork.com and Jimmy's 43 in the East Village. I'm Linda Palacio. I'd like to thank our producer, Jack Inslee, and our engineer, Nat Wiener. Too much beer, see? And, of course, our sponsor, TechServe, and Heritage Foods USA. Don't forget, if you call in, you'll get those free pork chops.
Jimmy Carbone and our live callers have all received 365-day gift cards, compliments of Zagat. Use this 365-day Zagat.com gift card to enjoy trusted Zagat ratings and reviews derived from the opinions of 375,000 surveyors around the globe, all conveniently located in one place. Go to www.zagat.com for more information. Thanks for listening.